Hello again, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 17th, 2002, and Fred Strickert, the Bible study leader, is leading another study in Luke's fascination with 40. This is session 3, the presentation of Jesus. Jesus turns 40 days old, that is. And so this is tape number STF-2002-03. Now let's join Fred and the group in the fireside room.
We can start the tape. I'm Fred Strickert from Waverly, Iowa, and I'm doing Bible study for these 2 weeks on Luke's fascination with 40. And be careful for the cord. And yesterday, for the dedicated people who were here, we talked about the temptation story where Jesus goes out in the wilderness, just as many of us have come to Holden Village in the wilderness to find renewal and strengthening and testing of who we are and what our priorities are. And so many of you decided to take the text literally and go out further in the wilderness and hike yesterday and test yourselves. And what we did a lot yesterday was making connections with the book of Deuteronomy, because the three quotations of Jesus there all come from one section, Deuteronomy 6 to 8. And this was the time where, during those 40 years in the wilderness, God tested Israel. And they were given food to eat, and they were able to see that God was their authority. And so, in a sense, Jesus reenacts that by going out to the wilderness for those 40 days. And we do that in a kind of structured way during the time of Lent, and we do it at other times, taking a vacation to the wilderness as well. So that's kind of what we did yesterday. Today, we're actually backing up chronologically. That was a text that's really fixed into the wilderness experience. And looking at the other 40, sometimes it's not so clear. But this is a text where Jesus turns 40, except it's not 40 years old, but when he's 40 days old. And I have it up on the screen here, Luke chapter 2, basically 22 to 40. And if you want a Bible to follow along, otherwise we'll have everything up here on the screen. But in looking at this, I guess the first question I have for all of you is, how many of you have ever seen a Christmas pageant? Has anybody here ever had that? I got everybody involved right away. Okay. Now, in a Christmas pageant, how many of you have ever seen the episode of Jesus being presented at the temple? And it's never included. But this is part of the infancy stories of Jesus in Luke chapter 2. So we always have the standard part that's in the Christmas stories. And this part never gets included. And part of it, okay, it's 40 days later. And part of it is, it's kind of awkward when we fit things together with Matthew and Luke. As far as the Christmas stories, we have a way of shoving the wise men and the shepherds together, even though they're two different stories and maybe they're at different times. But when Matthew has violence occur there in Bethlehem with Herod coming and killing the boy babies, of course, Joseph and Mary are told to, by an angel, to head off away from Bethlehem. But instead of going north to Jerusalem, they head south to Egypt and are there for, who knows, a couple years until it's safe to return. And so this, how to fit this in, is really kind of awkward. But so Luke doesn't talk about the boy babies being killed in Bethlehem. He doesn't talk about the sojourn in Egypt. But instead, after Christmas, has the holy couple heading north back to Nazareth and making the stopover in the temple on the 40th day. On the 40th day, according to the law. Now, as you look at this story, and some of you are reading through it, but we're going to kind of go through verse by verse. But the first thing I want to do here is look at the story and who are the characters. in the whole story. We just kind of look quickly. I want to kind of sketch out the characters.
Simeon.
Okay, we have somebody named Simeon, who's mentioned down here. And someone named Anna.
Jesus was involved.
Who shows up? Jesus is there.
His name may not be there, but he was the child.
That's, yeah. Okay. You said the word somebody. I don't know who's speaking here. Behind the post. The post is speaking to me. Okay. And it's interesting when you look at Jesus. I mean, is the name Jesus there? But you said the word child. And they keep emphasizing. And the child, and the child, and the child. I think
27
that's,
says the child, Jesus.
What verse?
27.
God, we get to 27.
Simeon came into the temple, and parents brought it.
Yeah. Now we get to 27, we get the child, Jesus. Okay, so we're clear which child it is there. Okay. As if we didn't know. But that's, it's interesting, this whole story is right in the middle of the text is where we get his name. But the rest of the time, it's the child, the child, the child, and emphasizing the child there, okay.
About the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. And have, okay, the Holy Spirit. We have a big section, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Emphasis on the Holy Spirit. Other characters? Okay. Father and mother. Now, and it's interesting that most of the time they're kind of in the background. You have the pronouns, they, all the way through. You get Mary mentioned by name. And, the child's father and mother. I mean, there's no discussion in this text about the whole question about Joseph's role as far as being father. That's what it's called, the parents or the father and mother, as if a typical family. Those are the actual human characters that are there in the story. We have five characters. And when I diagrammed all this, we put the child at the middle, which of course is the center of the whole activity here. And thinking about this, after 3 or 4 days now of having a child kind of at the middle of activity for me, if you've seen me around here, most of the young. Lil Maria isn't here to steal the show this morning, but it's kind of interesting how kids have a way of kind of pulling people together around them and kind of disarming people and that kind of thing. And the child is the center of attention, and maybe it's Jesus kind of speaking out and when things are quiet in the temple and disrupting the silence, or you know, shouting out or playing games or crying or all those kind of things, laughing. Children have a way of kind of pulling people together. And somebody, it was kind of interesting, we were kind of talking in the dining hall the other day about, you know, probably you've all been on committees that sometimes have, you've had disputes and things like that. And can't find a way of resolving the dispute. Probably the best thing to do would be bring a little baby to the meeting. And all of a sudden, those differences would kind of disappear for a little bit, and everybody's attention would be kind of going toward the child. Now, and looking at the story, we have two couples here that are kind of pulled together with the child. And what Luke is doing here, in a sense, is showing kind of the new reality, the foreshadowing of what the church is going to be. So I'm drawing circles here. As we are all in the Christian church in a circle, included kind of on an equal basis as the way we have everybody here around the one child. And when we kind of remember that, things kind of run smoothly here. As I look at this, as far as the role of Simeon and Anna, trying to think back first to the wilderness before we go to something else here, but thinking back to the wilderness story, as far as these two figures here, how are they described? How are they characterized? When you see Simeon and
old.
Oh, both of them are described as old. Simeon is you know, waiting for death, and you kind of, in the artwork, he's always pictured with a long white beard, usually kind of blind, and waiting for the Lord's Messiah before he sees death. And Anna is described in detail as being, what is she, 84 years old. And so you also get a contrast between young and old here with the two couples. If we kind of think as kind of the passing from one generation to the next, and I'm thinking of yesterday, we're talking about Deuteronomy, and almost in a way as Simeon is almost a kind of a Moses figure standing there at on Mount Nebo with the promised land, you know, getting to see the promised land. Here, Simeon gets to see the Lord's Messiah. He doesn't get to experience, you know, the adult Jesus and that, but he gets to see that. And maybe in a way, Anna is kind of a Marian figure, because she's described as a prophet, just like the sister of Moses was, you know, described as a prophet there. And it's almost like that generation from the wilderness is kind of passing on things to the next generation, which are going to be part of the settled existence. So this is kind of the new reality, and in a way the old reality may be part of what Simeon and Anna are all about. And when we look at the text, it all takes place at the temple. And it symbolizes, in a sense, kind of the structured, settled life in contrast to the wilderness kind of experience. But one of the things that kind of strikes me about the temple, and I'll look at the temple here. This is a drawing of the temple there in Jerusalem, probably what was like there at the New Testament times, the Mount of Olives off over here, and main part of the city over here. And it was a huge complex where Herod the Great had expanded the foundations. So from one corner to the next, 1,500 feet. Think about how large that is. From north to south, and then from this corner to this corner, it was like 900 feet. So it's a huge complex there in Jerusalem, up on this platform. And you see all different kinds of buildings. And smack dab in the middle, of course, is the temple, number one here. But what's interesting with Luke is that Luke, in this particular text, when he refers to the temple, there are two different words in Greek for temple. And this is always lost in translation, because it simply says, go to the temple. And you have pictures of Jesus cleansing in the temple, Jesus teaching in the temple. And, you know, we put everything in our mind as terms as, okay, this is church for me, and people are inside this church, and that sort of thing. But there are two different Greek terms. And in chapter 1, we have the story of Zechariah. The term naos is used, which is referring to this particular building. That's the temple proper. And in many of these other stories, they don't refer to the naos, but it's the other Greek term, the hieron, which is what referred to the temple as this whole courtyard, this whole complex, which is very stratified as society, as a typical kind of settled society. If we look at the floor plan of it, it's set up like this. We're right in the middle. This is where you have the temple itself. And what's important about it is when you have all these different parts of the temple, there are laws about who can go to what place. Society is very structured, and only certain individuals are allowed in certain places. And that's one of the things that the settled life does, is we start putting up boundaries so that you can do it in a spatial kind of way. So that even here, every building has its kind of its function. And sometimes it gets to be only certain people can go into certain buildings and that sort of thing. That's what you have here at the temple. And only the Jewish priests, the Jewish male priests, were allowed to go into the temple itself. And the section out here, the Jewish men were allowed to come when they had the prayers. And of course, I hope everybody can read as far as the size of the letters here, but this is the women's place at the temple. Women and men kept separate. It's structures. So the men get to go in here, the women get to go in here. And those boundaries, what are they saying about existence? So the women's gallery here, and out here, the court of the Gentiles, and you have a huge stone fence around there to prevent non-Jewish people from coming in. And it's so strict that if Gentiles would transgress and go inside this area, it's a death penalty. And there have been stone slabs that have been discovered from the temple that actually have those directions on there. Beware, Gentiles, keep out on penalty of death. And if you've read the story of Paul in the book of Acts, where Paul later in his life goes to Jerusalem, that's how he gets arrested. Because he has gone to the Jerusalem, and he's allowed to go into the court of the men here, the court of Israel. And when he comes out, people see him and realize he's been in there, but they've seen him with Gentiles in the city, and they figure this rascal Paul has probably taken some of his Gentile buddies in there, and he got to be killed for doing something like that. So it's very structured as far as the society. So the old reality is you put up all the boundaries as far as place, and you can do the same kind of thing with time. So you have calendars. This is what you do on day 8. This is what you do on day 40. So you structure your life very specifically. And maybe just simply with people themselves, we put people into categories instead of boundaries. What kind of boundaries we put up to separate people?
Color of skin.
Okay. Color, race, ethnicity. That's one way of setting up a boundary. So certain people can go here. One.
Age.
Age.
Gender.
Gender.
Financial.
Financial, I'm the right class maybe, but yeah, financial, poor versus rich.
Maybe religion.
Right, yeah, what religion you are, mm-hmm. And within religion, we divide people up?
Faith pieties.
I'm sorry?
Christian pieties.
We divide them up how pious or how religious. Yeah, we do that. Yeah. Worth it. I'm running out of spaces. That's what you're going to hit in just a minute. Clean and unclean. Those who take their baths. Those who are real wilderness people who preserve water.
That's dish team. Clean and unclean.
Oh, dish team. Okay. There's one other that comes up when we start talking about church and religion.
Occupation.
Occupation, and, well, it kind of all fits together. Within the church, we start talking about occupation.
Like clergy,
kind of. Yeah, occupation fits in class, but also, divisions between clergy and lay. In this story, we'll have priests and priests and lay people, or clergy and lay people. We have all these kind of divisions, and that's part of the settled life. Where in this kind of picture here, things are nice and simple. And somebody mentioned the Holy Spirit as one of the characters here. And that really fits in. We have the Spirit here in the middle. How many times is the Spirit mentioned here? Just underline all the Spirit. And Spirit's implied over here when you start talking about prophets. But the focus on this reality is the Spirit kind of functions in this dynamic way to give people gifts. You don't have to have one kind of pedigree or qualification of one sort or another, educational background. The Spirit gives people gifts, and you operate not according to time necessarily or place or class or whatever, but how the Spirit gives gifts. In contrast in this story, what strikes me when I read through this is how often it also mentions the law. Let's see if I can. How many times? You're going to have to help me out here because I got underlined references to the law. Where do we get?
22.
Law.
Or I get, okay, yeah. When the time came for their purification according to the law of Moses.
Again in 23.
And again in 23. As written in the law of the Lord. 24.
Mm-hmm.
What is stated in the law of the Lord?
27.
The parents did what was done customarily under the law. Is there any more there? Oh, get to the very end. What was required by the law. And that's kind of interesting how this comes together in the text. We have this focus on the spirit leading, but also following the law. And maybe that's intentional, because I mean, basically this is going back to the childhood of Jesus. And they're still in the age of the old reality under the law. I mean, Jesus has not died yet on the cross. And the parents are depicted as still part of that structured old reality, following all the laws. And of course, it's the laws that make all these kind of divisions. But at the same time, when you throw the child into the picture, it has that dynamic with the spirit of kind of changing everything. So if we take the child and throw the child in here, all of a sudden, people start acting in a different kind of way and start circling around the child and not sitting in their own little boxes here. So you have kind of both. I mean, this is Luke kind of looking ahead. How do you describe what's happening in the childhood of Jesus before the cross, before Pentecost? And so you get a combination of both things happening together. Now, the references to the law, we're going to look at this. There's actually two laws that come up here as far as following the law. Joseph and Mary are described as law-abiding parents here, doing everything according to the law. And first you have the law of circumcision. The child is circumcised on the eighth day, so that fits in. You've got to do everything according to time here. There's actually two laws, and the one in 23 comes from Exodus chapter 13, basically here has a quotation, every firstborn shall be designated as holy to the Lord. And 13 is the time of the Passover, where the firstborn had been killed in Egypt. And then the writer this is kind of toward the end of chapter 13, says, and because of partly remembering this kind of story and the importance of the firstborn, all the firstborn are looked at in kind of a different kind of way. So whoever opens the womb of the mother is seen as kind of special in God's eyes. So when it comes to the animal world, what do you do with the animals?
They're sacrificed.
The firstborn. I've left out one word intentionally here. The firstborn are always sacrificed to the child.
The males.
Yeah, we left off the word male. So here again, dividing things up. Right. Firstborn males are sacrificed in the animal world. And as far as the human world, they are dedicated to the Lord. They had a special ceremony where you were dedicated, firstborn male, and they could be redeemed. And so they would make a kind of sacrifice or a payment that would buy them back. Or other places like Samuel, though they are actually dedicated physically to the Lord. So that's one law, the dedication. So if you're born a male in that society, the law says you do one thing with males when they're born that's different from females. The other one, it says the purification here. Time for the purification. This comes from Leviticus, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. Most people know pretty well most of Leviticus. But one thing about Leviticus is that this is, you know, these are the laws written according, you know, to the priests. This is from the priest's perspective of how everything should be. So Leviticus chapters 12 through 15, there's all kinds of laws that are connected with biology. And I think it's chapter 15, if I'm not mistaken, it talks about emissions from the body that when certain fluids come from the human body, that there's certain laws that have to be followed. And I mean, it's interesting because it deals with both male and female. So it's women's menstruation and men, semen, they are unclean and have to wash and this sort of thing. But for childbirth, is chapter 12, this is something that's affecting the woman. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel, if a woman conceives and bears a, and now once again, it's certain kinds of kids, we're divided up by gender, a male child, she shall be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. We had the word unclean here before. That a woman is unclean when she bears a child. What kind of feeling does that give a woman, have the name unclean? Think about that. I mean, what kind of stigma? Be unclean. 7 days. And then it says, okay, so baby's born 7 days, the woman is unclean. The eighth day, if it's a male, he's circumcised. And then, on top of those 7 days, her time of blood purification should be 33 days. And she shall not touch any holy thing or come into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. So a woman is banned from going to church for 40 days. And this is practiced in part of Christendom yet today. And, I mean, a lot at least I know the Greek Orthodox Church, I don't know if they practice it here in the United States, but the East, they practice it. And it's practiced by Lutherans, Arab Lutherans, I know. We were living in Bethlehem. One of our friends, Nahida, I remember one Sunday visiting a Lutheran church in Bethlehem, and our friend Nahida had a baby, and at the end of the service, she's outside, and we finished the service, and at the end, after the benediction, the door opens, and she walks in. She walks up to the front, and the pastor has a special blessing for her. She was not able to go to church. I'm trying to think, what's her youngest child, male or female?
Female.
Female. So she's been away for some time. And then from then on, she can start going to church again. Which is something that, you know, totally out of our experience. But that's the way it was. And then, the difference male and female, what happens here? You're unclean 2 weeks. Now, some of you have given birth. Is there a difference in the boy babies and girl babies that you've had, as far as how unclean you are? What? It's 14 days, 2 weeks, and then the time is doubled. Instead of 33, it's 66. It says 80 days. So that means if Jesus had been born a Maria or a Sophia, Joseph and Mary would have had to wait until day 80 to take him to the temple, take her to the temple. It takes him to the temple at day 40. So, it's kind of interesting how the law ends up separated. And why? I have no idea. If any of you have any great ideas, it seems kind of odd. Then what happens is they have to make the appearance. Now, this is described when he's telling the tents of the meeting rather than the temple itself. But for her to become clean again, it takes a man, the priest. She has to appear to the priest after being banned. And she meets him at the entrance with a lamb. Now, what's not mentioned here is I think they usually had a mikvah, a ritual bath, that she had to go through as well. And that's not mentioned here. But she has to appear with a lamb and a pigeon. And they have to do an offering. The first one is described as a burnt offering. And the other one is a sin offering. So not only do you get the word unclean, but to think there's the concept of sin tied in here with childbirth. And then the last thing that we have here is I just want to mention here, she cannot afford the sheep. She can take two turtle doves or two pigeons. But she can't afford the lamb. So, I mean, they do allow, we talk about the distinction about wealth, that there is a way for people who are poor. So that is allowed in here. But this is the old reality. This is the structure under the law. Now, we all pause. Everybody anybody have any clear questions about this? Can we go right back to the text? Okay, back to the new reality. The story of Jesus at the temple. Remember, it says they're following the law, so they are following this reality. So, 8 days, time to circumcise a child, they do that. Now, what's interesting about this part here, the 8th day, the circumcision, whose job was it normally to do the circumcision? And not necessarily, no, I don't think it's necessarily a priest that does the circumcision. In fact, today in Judaism, they have an individual called a machel, who the skill that can do it would be often be the father who would do it. But it's interesting that in this case, the person who does this was, what did you say, the butcher?
I said yuck.
Oh, yuck. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It had to do a lot. Yeah. It's steady hands and that kind of stuff. Imagine. It's hard to believe. Doing this kind of thing. But the interesting thing is the person who does it isn't emphasized at all. We've left out, I mean, whether it was Joseph or whether it was some other figure there in Bethlehem who did it. It's told in kind of a passive kind of way of time to circumcise. So that kind of intermediary is kind of left out of the picture. It's not totally clear here. Now, when we get to this section, which actually talks about what happens with Mary and Jesus and the purification thing, let me just read this and listen to it and think about what is different about this text from the text that we read in Leviticus. When the time came for their purification according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as is written in the law. Skip that. And then 24, and they offered a sacrifice according to what is stated in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. Now, what we're almost looking at here is more is what is not said rather than what is said. What do you see that's different here? What's omitted?
Mary was unclean.
But yeah, doesn't say anything about being specific, unclean, or the term sin. That's totally left out of there.
It says their purification.
This is the most difficult word. And before I even mention that, one of the puzzling things is I'm going to come right back, so I'm going to so don't forget it. But it's kind of interesting because it's not specified as 40. We get 8 days here, and with Luke's fascination with 40, mentions 40 a number of times, but he's not specific here, but we know that this is the 40th day. And maybe it's part of that difference between males and females, 40 and 80. He just leaves that part out.
Well, he
leaves it to
Gentile.
Lillian. Because, I'm sorry?
He was a Gentile.
Who?
Luke,
yeah. And something, yeah. The way we're going to look at it, how much does Luke know about what's going on here? I mean, a lot of people have said, yeah, okay, he doesn't know what's happening here. He's real fuzzy about that. That's one approach a lot of commentaries have taken. I think he knows pretty well, and he's kind of deliberate in what he puts in and what he leaves out. That's kind of my approach. I think he studied it well enough to understand that. But the their purification, pronoun, who's their referred to?
Mary and Joseph.
I heard Mary Joseph, Mary and Jesus. Now the baby is never, there's nothing there for the baby to be purified. You know, the text only talked about the mother, right?
They brought him to Jerusalem, so I would think Mary and Joseph.
And yeah, so they brought him together. It's interesting how they use the pronouns frequently through the text. They refer to both Mary and Joseph. And if you go back, basically, that would be the antecedent. Mary and Joseph together. Their purification. And that didn't fit the law. Male's not unclean. Male doesn't have to do this. Did I see a hand go?
Well, I was going to say, but he can't have relations with Mary until she's
right.
Clean. Probably.
Yeah. So it affects him.
It's his too.
Yeah, it affects him. But according to the law, if you follow the law, it's just her. And in the Middle Ages, it's kind of interesting because a lot of the Greek manuscripts deliberately changed this and put her behind it. But it's quite clear, the old manuscripts, it's there. And I think that's the key to looking at this text, is we're moving from the old reality that separates and certain people do certain things to kind of an inclusive reality that says in a way, Joseph is saying, hey, Mary, if this is for you, I'm doing this too. Now, you think about moving beyond the law. You think of things like civil disobedience and that sort of thing. There's two different ways of doing things. One is Mary can say, this is the law. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to go to the temple and that sort of thing. And that'd be a way of saying, forget the law. The other way is Joseph can go and say, if she's doing it, I'm doing it too. And you kind of, it almost kind of comical picture there because, you know, the temple's all structured. And it's like Joseph is standing there in the court of the women. You know, it's obvious. I mean, if you take that literally, you know, it's obvious that he's kind of where he normally wouldn't belong according to the law. It's their purification.
Is there anything in there at all that indicates that maybe Joseph, knowing he wasn't biological father of Jesus, is trying to stand up and say, this is my child too, or taking responsibility for the child?
As far as I've heard that argument with, as far as the naming part here, that's a way of, you know, identifying, okay, by naming the child, he is taking responsibility, that part. But I haven't heard that part for this segment. But the
you mentioned something about the uncleanness for both male and female before. Was there such a thing as a mikvah for males to be clean? Be designated clean?
I don't know anything about a mikvah. I mean, men were supposed to wash after any kind of emission of semen and that sort of thing, but as far as having a special place.
Just washing in private, but.
Yeah. And that's the way it was very early on, but when everything became structured, there was even a place. So, I mean, even today, in synagogues, there's often, you have to go to the synagogue and either bath there or do bathe at home or anything. But now, for male, no. I don't know of anything. And Judaism, and that kind of thing.
Well, but weren't there a lot of requirements for the priests in doing the sacrifices?
Yeah.
And there they had to clean.
Yeah, they had all these kind of laws for the priests themselves. Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, and anything with dead bodies, mm-hmm. all of that.
Yep.
I mean, and those were often the men that were doing
those. Oh, exactly. Yeah. So you have that kind of thing. But as far as, you know, just a parent there, being involved, there was nothing there really for Joseph to do. And basically, he could have been, I mean, the typical male there would have dropped Mary off at the temple and have gone down to the coffee shop and had donut and coffee while Mary was doing her thing. And when she's done, pick her up and take her home. But it's their purification. Joseph standing by them. And that's, you know, the picture here. Of kind of the togetherness here. Anything else you notice there in that? What's there? What's not there? What's in this section here? Who's not there?
There's no mention of a priest.
Yeah, Luke totally omits the priest here. Totally omits the priest and the role of, again, that intermediary, just as the person who does the circumcising here. We know that they had to go through the priest to do it according to the law, but by omitting it, it's kind of looking forward to the time where people have direct access to God, so that the part of the clergy lay designation is we're not emphasizing the law. You know, if the priest would have written it, it would have written it totally different. And the bottom part here, the reference to a pair of turtle doves.
Indicating they were poor?
Poor, yeah. I mean, that's one of the texts of. They couldn't afford the lamb. This was a poor couple here that has come here to Jerusalem, and that's all they could afford. So they're accepted by God. Now, let's keep moving on, because the next part is the part of Simeon. And at least we're familiar with Simeon. And the part of the story that we're familiar with is basically this part up here, the poetry up here, the Nunc Dimittis. Because this is often used as a post-communion hymn. At least I grew up with this, and so I knew the Simeon part here. And as before, we describe Simeon as being elderly, looking forward to the coming of the Messiah. But he's an individual guided by the Spirit. And what is his role then in the story coming here? He is guided by the Spirit. The priests are guided by the law. And they're omitted. And in a kind of way, he kind of takes the role of the priest.
Well, if you
it seems like this is his way of authenticating the fact that this is a most unusual child.
Mm-hmm. The guy, the spirit moving him to come here is identifying that for the reader, that we know that there's something special that's different. This didn't happen. I mean, day after day, I mean, how many kids are brought to the temple? Or not how many kids, how many mothers come to the temple? And, there's not this kind of attention. So there's something special about that. But at this...
prophetic. It's a declaration of prophetic revelation.
Yeah, and that's why the spirit, the focus on Simeon is the spirit rather than the part of the law. And a spontaneous kind of thing happening with him on impulse, rushing up there. This is the point where after they finish this, the priest is supposed to give the blessing. And it's almost like you have the Simeon guy rushing up and get out of the way, priest. And the Simeon guy lays hands on Jesus. The layman here, guided by the Spirit, has taken the place of the priest. Which is kind of, and the emphasis that of his age there is important. Now, and we get to his song, I mean, it emphasizes the importance up here of the figure of the child here. As far as Simeon, the way he describes himself, let your servant depart in peace. And the footnote I have here, in a lot of your Bibles, literally, slave. Again, when you talk about the class part here, sees himself as a slave, but a slave who now has found peace through this child. But what's really interesting here, which you have prepared for whom? There he is in the temple, the center of the Jewish religion. And right here at the temple, you have something happening, not just for the Jewish people, but for all people. For the revelation for the Gentiles and Israel. So again, another one of these. I mean, we start clicking off all the differences here. We have both young and old, the Gentile, Jewish class, the lay clergy, all these kind of things come in. And the parents are amazed at what happens here.
Well, in 25, when he talks about Simeon being righteous and devout, anybody who was righteous and devout would never go up and push the priest out of the way.
Yeah, you know your place. And yeah, yeah. I mean, you see that in a lot of them, especially in Eastern churches and that kind of thing, that the regard that people have for the priests. You know, you should go out and kiss their ring or hand or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. You know your place and that sort of thing. Okay, I'm kind of watching the clock there. I want to get to Anna here, which is kind of interesting. Anna is usually just totally left out because Anna, we don't have a song for Anna, unfortunately. But notice how Anna is described here. Anna is the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of great age, having lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage, then as a widow to the age of 84. What kind of stuff strikes you about that?
All our identities. Based around man.
Men, yeah. And that's very common. The woman's identified in terms of their relationship to men. First, daughter of the father, or then married in terms of the husband. But in her case, what's happened? I mean, as far as who she is, what about the men in her life? She is an independent woman.
In my translation, it says Prophet Anna. In my translation, it says prophetess. Makes it feminine.
Is there a difference in that? And that's kind of interesting why they put that. Yeah. Does that say a prophetess is different from a prophet? Or?
Well, I don't know, but it's, like I say, it's men all around.
Is it just simply a gender thing? Or
mine says prophet.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. As far as the men, the one we just mentioned is that the interesting thing is she's daughter of Phanuel. So you have the typical way that she would be described. Of course, she's way too old. Phanuel is dead and gone. And her husband, she was only married 7 years, which probably means she's married 13. By age 20, she was a widow. And she's now 84, so 64 years She has lived in widowhood.
And it mentions no children. So in those 7 years, she never had a son nor a daughter. I mean, is that true?
Which, and if she had a son, the son would take care of her. But by emphasizing her role, I mean, the term widow here is very important. I mean, if you look through the prophets in the Old Testament, there's a constant refrain about being concerned for the poor, the widowed, and the orphan. People who don't have other people to take care of them. And so, you know, she doesn't have the standard ways of being looked after. And she's been independent for 64 years. And just one other thing, as far as what's striking here, she's of the tribe of Asher. With that detail, it's amazing how much detail about this one individual. When you take all the other gospel stories, how many women are even named? That's one thing I didn't even mention. She's got a name, which means that gives her value and worth. And you could imagine, I mean, with all this detail about her, you can kind of think of probably the way things were back then, how many people would see her come to the temple all the time, oh, that widow woman. And even as if, I imagine a lot of people didn't even bother calling her by name. And by calling her by name here is giving her an identity of how important she is. And even remembering that she's of the tribe of Asher, which is really strange, because, I mean, what do you know about Asher? I mean, that was, you have to almost go back to the book of Joshua to find out that stuff. Asher, what's interesting, is in Joshua, the list of all the tribes, Asher is usually the last one mentioned. The last. And all of a sudden, the last becomes first. Historically, basically what happens to Asher, I mean, if you know the history of the Old Testament, is you have the dispersion of the northern kingdom, and all the, you know, those 10 tribes kind of disappeared. Nobody even knows. But somehow, maybe that's part of her piety here, somehow she's still there. But once what was part of this small, unknown tribe that's kind of disappeared, she's still, you know, she's hanging on there. And what is she doing? She never left the temple. Never left the temple. Which is, who normally doesn't leave the temple?
The priest.
So again, she's kind of taking the place of the priest. Worship there with prayer and fasting every day. And she comes up there and shoves Simeon aside and says, I'm going to give this child a blessing and I'm going to proclaim. I mean, basically, he gives the blessing, but she's the one that goes out and tells everybody. She's the preacher, proclaimer. If you were here first day, I talked about the focus on proclaiming in Luke. She goes out there and tells everybody she sees. And so again, I mean, what you have here then is somebody unexpected, led by the Spirit, showing a new reality that's different from that very structured reality under the law with her. Last part here, they finished everything required by the law, and they returned. Essentially, it refers to their own town of Nazareth, which, now that's kind of confusing, partly when you read Matthew and Luke together, because in Matthew's gospel, it sounds like Bethlehem is really Joseph's town. And it seems like he's going to go and find his future in Mary's town. You normally expect Mary would leave her home and grow up in Joseph's town. And yet they kind of have that kind of way of finishing there. So what you end up having is breaking down a lot of the old reality with this child Jesus, all of a sudden in the center, totally changing things. So we have two couples who have direct access to God, not needing the priest here. And we have young, we have old. And we have the poor included. We have lay people who are included. We have a reference to Gentiles and Israel. And basically, almost all the categories are kind of stripped away. Okay, but still have 10 minutes here, so now we can do some talking about what you see.
I was looking at the terms at the very beginning. They were doing all of this according to the law. And then it talks about at the end, they had finished everything required by the law of the Lord. Now, I know in the Old Testament, the Lord signifies
Would you talk about the child in terms of the law, the law of Jesus?
I don't know. That's just what I'm so
questioning. Yeah. I don't think that would become. And I think it's talking about the Old Testament, the law of the Lord, and being the Old Testament.
I'm just thinking the irony here.
No, oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. And when you see the word Lord, I mean, Lord, the whole history of the word Lord is very interesting because it's the term used in the Old Testament that they substituted for Yahweh in the text. And then it becomes the term that's used for the risen Jesus.
Yeah. That old, term, the Divine Comedy, and it's the picture here. Mm-hmm. Right? It's almost like God is, is almost making a comedy of this.
Mm-hmm. So for the reader, we have... we have that post-Easter way of looking at that. But as far as the law, I would say it's looking at the old reality of the law.
Is there a distinction here between the law of Moses and then the law of the Lord?
The first one,
they referred to the law of Moses, then they referred to the law of the Lord. Could it be that Moses had a certain set of laws, and then after Moses...
But the way it's just, the whole history of giving the law, but I mean, basically... It's the law of Moses is the way it's given to him on Mount Sinai, so it's the Lord's law and the divine side of the law. So I think it's just different ways of saying the same kind of thing. But it was the religious, the emphasis is this was the old reality, the old understanding, the way we do things within the Jewish religion at that time. And Mary and Joseph, as still being part of that old reality, are still, they're not a bunch. They're not pictured as a bunch of rebels throwing off the law. They're still doing things. It's Jesus who will free them from the law, with the cross. So they're still following the law there.
It occurs to me too that this is such a gentle story. You think about all of the Old Testament law and so on, and how strict they were, how carefully people had to adhere to them, and all these things that you have brought up are going to be interesting. And how that creates a new reality, but it just seems like such a gentling.
Is that partly because of the way Luke is, the way Luke has told her? One part I did leave out, you talk about the gentle part here, and a sword will pierce your soul also. I mean, it's not an easy way. We're not going to move from the old reality to this new reality by just. Okay, we'll just turn the page. The swords will pierce your soul.
Well, it seems gentle, but I wonder how gentle it probably really was, because I would assume that this was the temple, that anything done that seemed to be a violation of the laws or the rules of the temple, I think would have caused all sorts of chaos. People rushing to deal with it. Yeah. You almost wonder if this was a chaotic scene.
And if, especially, moving from kind of our Western kind of way of doing things at church, if those of you who have visited Jerusalem, if you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and watch the different groups of priests doing things, and when somebody's out of line, there is yelling and, stamping of polls, disapproval, and people, and you kind of picture this kind of thing. The temple wasn't just this nice little quiet, pleasant place, but there's so much happening that people are making sure things happen, and they're very vocal in doing that kind of thing. I would kind of picture.
In the sacrifice, there's nothing that says that the doves or the turtle doves have to be male or female?
No, I think they're always male.
Always male.
Yeah. I think so.
When you say pair, you're saying that's not a male and a female? Pair of turtle doves?
No. Let me see if it... I'm just thinking of other times. As far as I know it, I don't know enough about the Old Testament. As far as I know, it's always male. And I think it's the part of the pair is, see, up here, you had a lamb and a pigeon. So you had two, you have to have two for the sacrifice. And that's the focus. You can have two turtle doves or two pigeons to do this. So there's actually two different offerings that are taking place. That's the emphasis on the pair rather than male and female, as far as what I know.
Chris? I was caught by verse 33 when it says that the child's father and mother were amazed at what was being said about him. And I was trying to remember where the other places were where it talked about people being amazed. Is it in Luke's gospel where the crowd is amazed at Jesus teaching with authority, or is that Matthew's gospel?
Yes, I think it's all three.
All three.
We talk about the authority. The people are amazed. He doesn't preach like the scribes.
I'm just picking up on the word amazed and connotations.
Yeah. It shows up in all the Gospels. I think Luke picks up on that in his response. And I think it's common in the storm to say the disciples are amazed at this kind of stuff. Often in Luke, they talk about the reaction, father and mother. Previously, it's often Mary, it's more kind of quiet, it's pondering things in her heart kind of thing. But here it's both parents here, emphasis on the reaction.
I guess like something totally new happening and no categories for it.
You sit there, wow, this is different. There's something unusual about this.
Your reference on the two turtle doves in Leviticus is turtle doves or pigeons, one for the burnt offering and one for the sin offering.
Yeah.
It doesn't identify
the gender. No. I mean, it's the emphasis that there has to be two because there's two different offerings. Yep, that's right. But I think as far as what I remember from sacrifice, that was actually before my time when we did the sacrifice. I don't have that memory. I think it always had to be a meal. It had to be about one nation. I almost think it was a meal.
Well, it makes sense. Agriculture is important to be a male.
Want
to give up your
meal. Exactly,
money.
Yeah. You don't want to give up. Yeah. Exactly.
Males are expendable in agriculture.
Wait a minute.
Come on.
Okay.
Only for
you.
I'm looking at that word in verse 25, the consolation of Israel. That's a new phrase to me. I don't ever remember that phrase in the Old Testament or New Testament. Jesus, or the idea of the Messiah as being the consolation of Israel. Mm-hmm. Is that a biblical term elsewhere?
Honestly, you got me totally. You have so many words that are almost cliches. You have redemption and salvation, the consolation. I agree. I can't think. The consolation of Israel. I honestly can't think of it. Maybe the.
What is that?
Right down here. Looking forward to the consolation of Israel.
Okay.
Over here I know we have salvation, redemption, terms like that. Okay. So that's just another parallel reading. And consolation is kind of interesting as a comforting term.
I'm especially trying to think if there's an Old Testament tie into that phrase, but
the closest thing I can say is comfort you, my people.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah, but okay. Well, I heard the bell ringing, and we're very structured here. So tomorrow I'm going to look at one little thing. When Jesus turns 30, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the age of Jesus and the view of. How did people look at age? What age was the kind of ideal age? So I've got some parallels from the Old Testament and also from the Greek literature about what people were supposed to do at certain ages and stuff. So that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. So hope to see a lot of you back. Come tomorrow. Have a good day.